Good evening. Welcome to the Sunday Monitor. This is KPFT 90.1 FM. If you listened to last week's show, you heard an interview with John Nichols, and one of the people that we used quotes from John Nichols' book is actually with us today, and that is Chalmers Johnson. He's going to be our first live guest. Chalmers Johnson, if you haven't heard of him, then you need to do some more reading. He's written some very, very good books. He's in the middle of writing the third of a trilogy. The first two are already out. The first one is called Blowback, The Costs and Consequences of American Empire. The second is called The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic. And the third, as I said, is being written currently. Dr. Johnson is the president of the Japan Policy Research Institute. He's been teaching for over three decades. After him, we'll be hearing from Larry Burns. He is the director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. You can look up their website at coha.org. He is a former defense researcher and a member of the Institute of Strategic Studies in London. And he's written about John Bolton, who is going to be nominated, and there'll be hearings for him tomorrow. And they'll be carried live here on KPFT all through the day. They'll be hosted by Larry Bensky. Tune in tomorrow from 8 for those. We have a pretty packed show. We also would like to welcome back Farah Chomchi. We haven't seen her in a long time. She's going to be giving us a couple of headlines, and we'll start with those right now. Pokey is up first.
Thank you, Mark. And by the way, for those of you who like to listen on the archives, it's down right now. We have some of our older shows on there, but it's not up, and we are hoping to get that back real soon. This has been a week of pressure on the judiciary. First out of the box was local Congressman Tom DeLay, speaking of his distaste for a judiciary decision involving the Terri Schiavo matter. He said, quote, "The time will come for the men responsible for this to answer for their behavior." Not long after that, another Texan, Senator John Cornyn, mused about how a perception that judges are making political decisions could lead people to, quote, engage in violence. He, of course, said he didn't condone violence. But then a gathering of right-wingers in Washington started discussing how to impeach centrist Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy. As Dana Milbank wrote in yesterday's Washington Post, Phyllis Schlafly, who made her name as an anti-feminist and conservative long ago, said that Kennedy's opinion forbidding capital punishment for juveniles is a, quote, good ground of impeachment, unquote. Milbank reports that those gathered at a Washington hotel for the conference confronting the judicial war on faith applauded loudly when Schlafly said that Justice Kennedy had not met the good behavior requirement for office and that, quote, Congress ought to talk about impeachment. Another speaker, Michael Ferris, said Kennedy should, quote, be the poster boy for impeachment because he cites international norms in his opinions. Quoting Ferris, if our congressmen and senators do not have the courage to impeach and remove from office Justice Kennedy, they ought to be impeached as well. Lawyer author Edwin Vieira told the gathering that Kennedy should be impeached because his philosophy, evidenced in his opinion striking down an anti-sodomy statute, quote, upholds Marxist, Leninist, satanic principles drawn from foreign law, unquote. Vieira continued by saying his bottom line for dealing with the Supreme Court comes from Joseph Stalin. Quote, he had a slogan and it worked very well for him whenever he ran into difficulty. No man, no problem, Vieira said, quoting Stalin. The full Stalin quote provided by Dana Milbank is, quote, death solves all problems. No man, no problem. But, of course, with the murder of a judge in Atlanta and the murder of a husband and mother of a judge in Chicago recently, this might not be such a good time to be quoting that particular Stalin piece of quote wisdom. Dana Milbank suggested that Justice Kennedy might want to get a few more bodyguards. But there are a couple of instances involving justices in the past 2 years that are little known. Normally, when justices go to public affairs, they are accompanied by court police officers or U.S. marshals. But in their daily lives, they go about mostly as regular citizens without protection. But there was an incident in April of 2004, right after the Supreme Court heard oral arguments on Yasser Hamdi and Jose Padilla. Justice David Souter was attacked by unknown assailants while out jogging in Washington. He had minor injuries, was taken to a hospital, and was released. Robbery was not involved. the Supreme Court was closed-mouthed about the entire event, not even releasing the number of attackers nor description. The year before that, after the Supreme Court decided the Michigan affirmative action case and the Texas sodomy case, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor had a heavy frame collapse nearly on her in Philadelphia. She was not hit, but was heard through an open microphone saying, quote, "We could all have been killed." Several other people, including the mayor of Philadelphia, were hit, hospitalized, and released. So maybe a bodyguard and a helmet.
Thanks, Pookie. Officials in Iraq have reportedly failed to maintain scores of water, sewage, and electrical plants refurbished with U.S. funds, this according to today's L.A. Times. Their neglect is believed to have cost millions of American taxpayer dollars. Rebuilding the country's water and sewage systems, a multi-billion dollar task, is considered among the most crucial components of the effort to improve the daily lives of Iraqis. Iraq's power grid faces a similar problem. U.S. officials said the Iraqis' inability to properly operate overhauled electrical plants contributes to widespread power shortages this winter. For Iraqis, the consequences are life-threatening. School children step over rancid brown puddles on their way to class. Families swim in, fish in, and get their drinking water from the polluted Tigris and Euphrates rivers, leading to high rates of child mortality and waterborne illnesses. U.S. officials blame insufficient training, logistical problems, and an indifferent work ethic learned under the regime of Saddam Hussein. Iraqis say the Americans excluded them from the early stages of the projects and have not provided adequate funds for upkeep. One official involved in reconstruction estimated that, quote, hundreds of millions had been squandered because of improper operation and maintenance of U.S.-funded projects. A State Department report to Congress on Thursday acknowledged the problem and proposed shifting $607 million to pay for additional operation and maintenance programs to protect U.S. investment in the projects. The United States has required the corporations contracted to carry out the reconstruction to train Iraqis to operate the new power and water plants. Most of those corporations are American, with Bechtel being one of the most prominent. Once facilities are handed over to the Iraqis, however, U.S. officials say they no longer exert control. If the Iraqis run the projects badly, the U.S. can offer advice, but it says it will not intervene.
Staying with Iraq news for a moment, according to Tom Regan of the Christian Science Monitor, a former advisor of the U.S.-led Coalition Provisional Authority, or CPA, which ran Iraq until the election of an interim Iraqi government in January, says that the U.S. government's refusal to prosecute U.S. firms accused of corruption in Iraq is turning the country into a, quote, free fraud zone, unquote. Newsweek reported earlier this week that Frank Willis compared Iraq to the Wild West, and that with only $4.1 billion of the $18.7 billion that the U.S. government set aside for reconstruction of Iraq having been spent, the lack of action on the part of the government means the corruption will only get worse. More than U.S. money is at stake. The administration has harshly criticized the United Nations over hundreds of millions stolen from the Oil for Food program under Saddam Hussein's regime. But the successor to Oil for Food, created under the occupation, called the Development Fund for Iraq, could involve billions of potentially misused dollars. In late March, the New Standard in Scotland reported that the annual global corruption report issued by the corruption watchdog Transparency International heavily criticized the U.S. for mismanaging Iraq's oil revenues and for using faulty procedures for awarding reconstruction contracts. The report also criticizes efforts to rapidly privatize Iraqi assets and industries as a means of reducing the country's debt. TI warns that unless immediate corrective measures are taken, Iraq's reconstruction could become the biggest corruption scandal in history. We did have former UN Assistant Secretary Dennis Halliday to discuss the Oil for Food program, and we'll be getting somebody on to discuss its replacement under the CPA. Actually, we contacted the Christian Science Monitor journalist, and we hope to have him on maybe as early as next week to talk about this.
This week in Stockholm, at the Parliament building, Swedish feminists held a press conference to launch the Feminist Initiative, a prelude to a future political party. This platform includes the former leader of the Left Party, Gudrun Scheiman. The Feminist Initiative does not yet have a definite program, but supports different ways of doing business, like having equal salaries and work conditions, reports Le Figaro. Quote, "At this stage of the movement, we don't want people to feel they are adhering to a list of pre-decreed demands," said Ebba Witt-Brodström, 50-year-old figurehead of Swedish feminism. The Social Democrats established a 50% quota for women on government electoral lists. And Swedish political parity has been born previously. But that was in response to a threat by the feminists that they would start a party if something wasn't done. However, still women are receiving lower salaries, occupy lower positions, and are virtually absent from senior management of Swedish companies. They only have 15% of board members there. The political class, especially on the left, but also the right, takes this feminist initiative very seriously in Sweden. Everyone remembers that it was women who dissented, keeping Sweden from adopting the euro in 2003. A quarter of Swedish voters already are intending to vote for the Feminist Party in 2006. As many as 28% of young men will give it their vote. Quoting Ebba Witt-Brotström again, "Men are welcome. We are not just a women's party." Meanwhile, the largest political faction in Norway, the opposition Labour Party, voted on Saturday to enforce a 50-50 gender quota throughout the organization. AFP reports that the party previously guaranteed men and women at least 40% of party positions. The party said in a statement, quote, "This is Europe's and possibly the world's first political party to introduce full gender equality." Norway, already considered a world leader when it comes to women's rights, had 30% female representation in parliament in the last 4 years, and women made up about 42% of the government last year. According to recent polls, the Labour Party is positioned to remain Norway's largest party following parliamentary elections in September. In another move aimed at bolstering gender equality, the Norwegian parliament has also adopted a law requiring Norwegian companies to voluntarily appoint at least 40% women and 40% men to their boards of directors by July. Since 2002, the percentage of women in boards has risen only from 6% to 11%. Norway has had no teeth in their recommendation until now, but a cabinet minister says companies that refuse to cooperate by 2007 will be shut down.
According to an article in today's Washington Post, scores of physicians across the United States are given repeated chances to practice, despite well-documented drug and alcohol problems. They stay in business with the permission of state medical boards and hospitals, even when many of them have relapsed multiple times, ending in injured patients. In 74 Virginia cases in which doctors were disciplined, most of them had their license suspended only temporarily. 10 doctors were reprimanded, and 5 others were placed on probation, but their licenses still weren't suspended. Critics say lenient treatment of substance-abusing physicians flows from a seriously flawed national system of disciplining doctors. At its heart is a network of state medical boards made up primarily of physicians unwilling to punish their colleagues. A federal data bank designed to track problem doctors has critical loopholes, and it's closed to the public. Malpractice lawsuits often end in sealed settlements, adding to a cloak of secrecy that keeps patients from learning a doctor's full history. Patient advocacy groups say bad doctors are also protected by hospitals and other employers within their culture of clemency and second chances. Medicine tolerates behavior that in any other industry would be unacceptable, said Lucien Leap, a physician and expert on patient safety who teaches at the Harvard School of Public Health. There are patients' lives at stake, she says, and that's more important than a doctor's career.
Well, we have a couple more headlines, and we're going to take a break, but I just wanted to update you on a story that we mentioned last week about emails commenting on the falsification of documents at the Yucca Mountain nuclear waste dump. Three people have been named as authors of those emails. They are Joe Hevesi, Alan Flint, and Lorraine Flint. Well, the representative from Nevada, Republican John Porter, requested the presence of the three to meet with the subcommittee and staff regarding statements contained in those emails. Just to remind you, a couple of the statements were including these two. One said, quote, "I don't have a clue when these programs were installed, so I've made up the dates and names. This is as good as it's going to get. If they need more proof, I'll be happy to make up more stuff," unquote. Well, only redacted versions of the emails have been made public, so it's impossible to tell which role any of these three have had. The subcommittee declined to elaborate, but all three are listed on the USGS website as research hydrologists in Sacramento, California. Associated Press tried to contact them. They did not return any calls. However, The director of the Interior Department's Office of Congressional and Legislative Affairs, Matt Eames, did respond to the request made by John Porter, and he said that they're not going to be testifying. He said in a letter, quote, "Given the potentially serious implications for the employees involved, the department believes it is inappropriate to require the individuals identified by the subcommittee to testify in a public hearing about the matters under active investigation," unquote. We'll continue to follow this for you, and we'll update you as we go along.
The FBI used a secret search warrant to copy and seize material, including DNA samples and computer drives, from the home of Brandon Mayfield, a Portland, Oregon man who was wrongly arrested and jailed last year in connection with the March 2004 train bombings in Madrid. The Justice Department previously declined to confirm Mayfield's contention that his house had been ransacked in a covert search. But, according to Washington Post report, the Justice Department is now acknowledging that it did so. It had, in statements and testimony this week, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez and other justice officials have admitted some of the special powers used to spy on Mayfield were strengthened by the USA Patriot Act. The disclosures prompted Representative John Conyers to ask the Justice Department's Inspector General to expand his ongoing investigation of the case. Mayfield, a convert to Islam, was arrested May 6th after the FBI decided that his fingerprint was on a bag of detonators connected to the bombings in Madrid. He was freed 2 weeks later after the FBI admitted it had bungled the fingerprint analysis. Mayfield is suing the federal government. In a letter to Mayfield sent as part of the lawsuit, the Justice Department acknowledged that during clandestine searches of Mayfield's home, the FBI made copies of computer drives and documents, and that, quote, 10 DNA samples were taken and preserved, and 6 cigarette butts were seized for DNA analysis, unquote. Authorities took approximately 355 digital photographs. Also in the Justice Department letter, it said, quote, "Mr. Mayfield is hereby notified that he was a target of electronic surveillance and other physical searches authorized pursuant to FISA, meaning the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, a little known law that governs warrants and which was expanded under the Patriot Law.
Well, that's all the time we have for news. We're going to take a very quick break. When we come back, we'll be spending the next 20 minutes or so with Chalmers Johnson. Stay tuned for that.
And we are pleased to have back with us again, Dr. Chalmers Johnson. Welcome to Sunday Monitor again, sir.
Thank you very much. It is a pleasure to be here.
He's quite a prolific author. Is it 15 or 16 books you have now?
16.
16.
That's over a long time.
Right. One of the recent ones is part of a trilogy, Blowback, The Costs and Consequences of American Empire, and then Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic. And he's working on another volume. He's president of the Japan Policy Research Institute. He taught for 30 years at University of California, and he's been back and forth in Japan very often. And he has a new article called Wake Up that you can find in These Times or at Truth Out. I believe it's also there. So we'll be talking with you today about some of the many issues that you cover in your research. Let's start out with economics. You say in your new article, Wake Up, that we are facing imminent danger of bankruptcy here in the United States, and that, quote, within the next few months, the mother of all financial crises could ruin us and turn us into a North American version of Argentina. And you say, to avoid this, we must bring our massive trade and fiscal deficits under control and signal to the rest of the world that we understand elementary public finance and are not suicidally indifferent to our mounting debts. This sounds pretty bad.
Well, I think it is pretty bad. That's why I put it that way. I mean, it's a matter of saying, yes, the U.S. in Iraq and in is a malignant force in the world today, with its acceptance of torture, its so-called extraordinary renditions of people who have no rights at all once they're seized by the CIA. But whether the American public is interested in these things or not, there is one thing that they're not going to be able to avoid, and that is the growing possibility of bankruptcy. It's Herbert Stein, years ago, when he was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers in a Republican administration, rather famously said, things that can't go on forever don't. Well, what can't go on forever is the United States' extraordinary expenditures being financed by foreigners who are in, particularly in East Asia, particularly the Chinese and the Japanese, who are serious savers in the way the Americans are not, and that they face today with the decline of the dollar, as the rest of the world recognizes how irresponsible these budgets are, the possible very catastrophic loss of their reserves held in dollars. And the you'll recall just in February, the Central Bank of Korea one day said it would like, it has about $200 billion worth of U.S. currency as its in its reserves, that it's considering shifting some of these from dollars into euros in order to protect itself against the situation developing in the United States. The moment it said that, it produced the worst day on Wall Street in 4 years and led to instantaneous denials that it was thinking of doing any such thing. It just gave us a hint of what a knife edge we are sitting on as the president keeps talking about one more gimmick after another, from the Social Security to more weapons that we simply aren't paying for, we're just putting on the tab.
Well, you wrote in your book, Sorrows of Empire, that it was the Reagan defense buildup that kind of sent us down the chute to being the world's largest debtor nation. Is that really where we kind of lost it?
That's what had happened in 1985 when Japan became the world's largest creditor nation. We became the world's largest debtor nation. We are easily the largest debtor nation today. We require about $2 billion per day of foreigners being kind to us by deciding to buy American treasury certificates or American currency or things of this sort, and that there's less and less incentive for them to do so, particularly as the European Union comes together. The euro is a considerably more valuable currency. The European Union itself is a market every bit as large as that of the United States. With China and India, the fastest growing countries on Earth today, and with a huge consumer demand, the United States is doesn't, for all of its imperial pretensions, it doesn't have the economy that goes with them.
Well, you wrote that when Britain was really, you know, the top dog, they had a surplus.
Well, true. On the eve of the First World War, Britain was running current account surpluses in the range of 6 or 7% of gross domestic product, whereas we are today approaching a 6% deficit in terms of our trade and current account deficits. This is this would be unlikely in any country. That's why I say it's when you got into those kind of numbers, you had a collapse such as you did in Argentina, the richest country in Latin America, and the poster child of following American economic advice, and it is, remains today a in almost permanent recession. The that could happen to us is what I'm trying to say. That it's the issue that hovers behind every meeting of the Federal Reserve Board. It is the continuous source of discussion in the international financial press, such as the Financial Times in London. And everybody knows it's out there. It could happen at any time.
Talking with Dr. Chalmers Johnson. And even the IMF, which likes to tell developing countries what to do.
And pretty well it's owned by us, yes.
They have even rattled the worry a little bit and said, oh, gee, the United States has a lot of debt.
Everybody is alarmed by it. It doesn't make sense. And, of course, it contradicts everything taught in Econ 1A in any American university, that countries that are as indifferent to the bills they're piling up as the United States is, that their currencies become worthless, they suffer very considerably and are forced by bankruptcy to bring their budgets back into line. We're not forced to do that for one reason, that now and for how much longer we don't know. We can call the shots by simply printing money, since the rest of the world accounts for things in dollars. But if, for example, which easily could happen, the OPEC countries, or particularly Persian Gulf oil producers, should decide to start accounting for oil sales in euros, considerably more valuable currency than the dollar today, than the dollar, this would produce an instant crisis in the United States, and it would, if we had to start financing our own instead of borrowing from others, you would have interest rates that were up in high double digits. It'd be like Jimmy Carter days again, in 20% or so. If you were going to get Americans to save that much money, you'd have to really give them some powerful incentives to do so.
Well, some people have said that countries in the Middle East are almost de facto pricing in euros, because if you look at the price in euros of oil, it has not gone up nearly as much as the price in dollars.
Yeah, it's quite true. I mean, that is to say, but this also reflects general American arrogance in the world and the degree to which the rest of the world loathes what we're doing and prepares in ways that it can, without directly provoking the Pentagon, which is sort of our government today, do what they can to isolate us and to not come under our influence. It's to say, this is not, there's nothing inevitable about this. It doesn't have to happen. It may well be that the Chinese and the Japanese will continue to lend us money forever in order to still have access to our market for their exports and on terms that they like. But it is to say, elementary prudence. It's unwise for a massive debtor to spend much time insulting his banker. Well, we do that all the time. We insult the Chinese every time we turn around. One wonders, as they get richer and more comfortable, they're the fastest growing big economy on Earth today at 9.5% a year, and they've been doing that for the last 20 years. At some point, they must decide, in my opinion, there's no point. It's not even good sense any longer to continue to invest in the American economy. Let them go.
Well, let's talk a little bit about China. While we sit here and worry about Terry Schiavo and whatever, Michael Jackson, China has been making deals with Iran, mm-hmm. with Latin America, including Venezuela.
Right.
Talk a little bit about in fact, I just read this from the vice president of Cuba, Ricardo Alarcón Quesada.
Yes.
He mentioned that in December, the Chinese president toured Latin America and discussed granting Argentina a credit line of $20 billion.
Right. It also signed any number of deals in Brazil to buy agricultural products, to invest in Brazil. In fact, Brazilian trade with China has just grown exponentially. The truth of the matter is, I don't find this alarming. It's American militarists who find it alarming. China has turned decisively in a commercial direction. In a certain sense, their Marxist moment is happening now, when they've become among the most materialist people on Earth, whereas under Mao Zedong, they were actually idealists and had very idealistic ideas of what their revolution might achieve. Emulating the rest of rich Asia that was pioneered in the post-war world by Japan, which was itself also emulating our particular brand of unrestricted capitalism. Under these circumstances, they have tremendous demands for energy, for raw materials, for food, and at the same time, they're turning into a manufacturing powerhouse. Anything can be manufactured in China today cheaper than it can be manufactured anywhere else, and they're enjoying getting rich, as they say. It's going very, very well. The danger here is the United States is still caught in a mindset, in a gestalt back from the Cold War, that says we can solve problems with cruise missiles and carrier task forces, and that we still wish to regard the Pacific as an American lake, and that what goes on the China coast is our business, and you've got to first get the approval of Washington. These are outdated ideas. The real story from East Asia is the explosive growth of commerce. China is easily South Korea, our allies, a leading trading partner. If only the American militarists would pull back, the old long-standing crisis in the Chinese Civil War between mainland China and Taiwan would probably solve itself through economic integration. If you travel from Shanghai up the Yangtze toward Wuxi or toward even Nanjing, you'd almost think you're in Taiwan when you see the amount of Taiwanese investment there. It's the United States in 1890. They're exploding as a great new economy. There's nothing you can do to stop it. You have to therefore adjust to it, and it's altering the world balance of power.
Well, it seems that, you know, the thing that the United States is really best at right now is being a bully. I mean,
yes,
just
I think so.
Just saying it right out there. And also, it's the world's largest arms salesman, as you write in The Sorrows of Empire,
right.
Responsible for 47% of all munitions transfers between 96 and 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And you bring up the...
That's why it seems a little odd to have us complaining so wildly and so hysterically about Europe lifting its arms embargo in sales to China, which was imposed after the Tiananmen Square demonstrations of 1989. Many Chinese governments have come and gone since then, and we've had a quite new policy. We have, you know, millionaires as members of the Politburo these days in China. It really is the pot calling the kettle black for the United States to complain about European arms sales.
Well, and of course, biochemical weapons and all that.
Precisely.
As some people said, you know, when they found a pool of them outside of Washington, D.C., we found the WMDs, and they weren't being accounted for. Nobody even knew they were there. There was this pool of toxics out there. One of the things you mentioned in an article called No Longer the Lone Superpower, Coming to Terms with China, in Tom Dispatch, you mentioned that after World War II, Japan put in its constitution basically that it was a pacifist country. It wouldn't be...
True. Article 9 of the Constitution.
Wouldn't be running hostilities and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And that the United States, more recently, has been wanting Japan to rearm. Why on earth would we do that?
Well, we actually, many of the neoconservatives in Washington, D.C., speak of Japan as an East Asian version of Great Britain. That is, as a secure, solid satellite of the United States, not doing anything until it gets its orders and approval from Washington, pretending to be an ally and part of our so-called coalitions of the willing. And Japan seems, I believe it's a tragic mistake on the part of the Japanese, but they seem willing to go along with the United States in this activity, rather than trying to come to grips with extremely dynamic China that is not an economic or military threat to them. It is that is nothing could damage China's growth more faster than war, or with South Korea or things of this sort. Instead, they seem to, that is, what they've been doing is stealthily rearming by passing now well over 20 different pieces of legislation that restore Japanese military strength. They have a huge military budget that is, again, is also more or less covert. And the ruling party in Japan, which, of course, Japan is a single-party regime that has been ruled since 1955 by a single party, it's in the process right now of revising the Constitution in order to get rid of Article 9. All of this is hailed enthusiastically by the neoconservatives in Washington, D.C., who see Japan, like Britain, as one of the few places left on Earth in which the government, if not the public, is sycophantly obedient to the United States.
If I could just interrupt for a moment, I actually was you mentioned that the neoconservatives are very keen on this, but Colin Powell, who's not commonly thought of as being a neoconservative, he said in August of last year that if Japan is going to play a full role in the world stage and become a full active participant member of the Security Council and have the kind of obligations that it would pick up as a member of the Security Council, Article 9 would have to be examined in that light. So it sounds like
it's more than neoconservatives. You're quite right.
Right.
I agree with you. I mean, that is that remark when Colin Powell made it, he made it in Tokyo,
right,
caused an uproar in the Japanese press because it was as explicit an interference in the affairs of an allegedly sovereign country. I say allegedly because bear in mind, we have 91 American military bases in Japan and particularly in its southernmost prefecture, Okinawa, which is for all intents and purposes an American military colony, much to the displeasure of the people who live there. But you're quite right that the Americans, though they were the actual authors of Article 9 of the Constitution, in which Japan renounces the use of military force, that the Americans are today actively trying to rescind it. And their policies, the American policies, seem to be to recognize that we are overstretched, that we have a bad case of imperial overstretch. But if we do, as has been a neoconservative principle for since they began to come into being after the end of the Cold War, that China is the only potential future enemy that we might truly face, we're trying to create Japan as a proxy to confront China.
Well, just wanted to let people know that you're listening to the Sunday Monitor. This is Mark Bowie with Perky Anderson, and we are speaking with Dr. Chalmers Johnson.
In one of the PNAC documents, Project for a New American Century, one of the strategies mentioned was to try to encircle China, I guess just the same way we tried to encircle the Soviet Union.
Well, I think that's quite true, and it's one of the reasons for the remarkable concentration of American military bases in Central Asia, including, of course, the bases in Kyrgyzstan, in which we have been participating in the recent instability there.
What do you make of that, by the way, the Kyrgyzstan uproar?
Well, it looks like, in the old days of the Comintern, we used to speak of communist front organizations. We need to rebuild that term today. We call them NGOs and claim that we're building something called civil society, but that the activities in Georgia, in the Ukraine, and now in Kyrgyzstan appeared. It's hard to imagine they could have happened the way they did without considerable money supplied via the local U.S. Embassy and the CIA to various organizations. It is, and one doubts very much that this actually is intended to implant democracy in a place like Kyrgyzstan or any of the other former Soviet Central Asian republics that are still ruled essentially by former USSR officials, and who, as in Tajikistan, it is they maintain one of the most remarkable Stalinist-type cults of the personality you can imagine anywhere on Earth, but that the purposes are oil and imperialism, and indeed the Chinese are themselves somewhat alarmed by this encirclement. At the same time, you have Chinese officials now visiting in India and making very warm statements with a nation that's often been hostile to China to try and reconcile themselves. It's to say the Americans aren't the only ones active in the world right now. The Chinese are extremely active in Iran, where they are Iran's leading trading partner these days. They buy petroleum from Iran.
Well, one of the ideas supposedly was to isolate Iran, and it seems like the United States may become the country that is isolated.
Well, it is at times isolating itself by its inconsistent and, as you say, bullying behavior. I think in the case of China, we're not talking about one of Bush-Cheney's little regime change wars, which they've said they'd like as many as 50 or 60 of them. Here we're talking about a world war that would alter the world. If it comes to a war between the United States and China, encouraged by Japan or because we have blundered still further into the Chinese Civil War over the case of Taiwan. Well, then we're talking about a conflict that would militarize the Chinese leadership. We would probably ultimately lose it. It would be fought on the same kind of terms as the Vietnam War, except with the world's largest social system, a country five times larger than we are and well on its way toward having an economy as big as ours. It would divide Japan wide open, because you would have Japan back involved again with the country that it's still accused of war crimes in, China and Korea, during World War II. Not just accused, they've certainly been documented. The objection here is that Japan refuses to acknowledge them and atone for them in the way that Germany did, for example, after World War II. So that it's a... the issue here is not one that can be solved by military force. It is one that can be solved by intelligent diplomacy, by adjusting to genuine changes in the world balance of power. As I try to argue in the piece that you mentioned on no longer the sole superpower, if the main issues of the 20th century, the last century, were the inability of the established powers, such as Britain and the United States, to adjust to new centers of power in Germany, in Russia, and in Japan, and led to catastrophic world wars, as well as 40 years long worth of Cold War. Well, that issue is here with us again. Can the world adjust to the reemergence of China? It is the world's oldest, continuously extant civilization, in some way that does not produce world war. Unfortunately, so far, the trend of events is not promising.
We are just about out of time. There's a, bumper stickers are kind of fun sometimes. One of them is "Yo, George, you promised humility, not humiliation." Maybe the humility ought to be brought back somehow.
Well, I certainly would agree with you. I mean, the thing that's mystifying about this government is that it simply doesn't make sense that George Bush, in the week after 9/11, said to Congress, quoting the Bible, he didn't say so, but it was, and he said he likes to think of himself, I think, as Jesus Christ, but he said, "You're either with us or against us." Well, since that time, a great many more people are against this than they were in 2001. In fact, it looks like virtually the entire rest of the world. It reminds me of an old phrase of Mao Zedong's 40 years ago, when he said U.S. imperialism was the common enemy of all the people of the world. Then it seemed like a provocative and warlike statement. Today, it seems like a mere observation of fact.
Dr. Chalmers Johnson, thanks so much for being with us.
It's a great pleasure to be on your program.
I really appreciate it. He is the author of many books, including Blowback and also The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic. And we'll be watching for your next volume to come out.
Thank you.
Welcome back. You're listening to KPFT 90.1 FM. That was Chalmers Johnson, and staying with a sort of relatively similar theme, we have Larry Burns on the show now. And Larry is the director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. You can visit their website at coha.org. He's a former defense researcher and member of the Institute of Strategic Studies in London, and a public affairs officer for the UN Economic Commission for Latin America in Santiago, Chile. He's taught and lectured for 15 years on the fields of Latin American studies, comparative government, and international law at a number of U.S. and U.S. and British colleges and universities. Larry, welcome to the Sunday Monitor.
Hello to you.
We want to talk to you about John Bolton. I don't know if you had any comments on the interview with Chalmers Johnson that I know you're listening to, if you want to try and tie any of that in to John Bolton.
Well, I was fascinated by the concept of isolation that the United States is now experiencing. Certainly, this is true in Latin America, and it is remarkably true that the United States, which particularly with this administration, but all administrations before it, established a kind of creedal belief that Cuba had to be isolated, and this very much became the fulcrum of U.S. policy, and certainly in this administration, which it's the obsession. And seeing things through a anti-Cuban prism, and almost defining what the initiatives you will follow in the rest of Latin America by what's at play in Cuba. The result is that we now have a belt of neo-New Deal governments extending below Cuba from Venezuela to Brazil to Argentina to Uruguay and very likely to Ecuador and Bolivia as the situations in both of those countries become very volatile. And ultimately, and to the great alarm of Washington, next year there could have been a left-of-center government in Mexico, right there on the U.S. border, with the victory of López Obrador, the mayor of Mexico City, which, of course, right now, López Obrador is being the subject of a congressional inquiry in Mexico over a very minor matter, which could have the result that of preventing him from running for office, which could produce a convulsive reaction in Mexico, because this man, López Obrador, a populist, very engaging man, a man that Mexicans seem to trust, and they trust few others, this man is being purposely excluded from participating in the political process. But the result of all of this is that Washington has never been as unpopular in Latin America as it is today. 85% of Latin Americans in a series of polls were shown to have been against a Bush victory in the last election. And we are seeing Latin America think about twinning itself with the EU and not going it with the U.S., and the U.S. almost on a daily basis suffers small defeats and large in various Latin American settings.
Well, you've spent a lot of time researching and writing about Latin America, and one of the people that we've mentioned several times on this show over the last few months is Hugo Chavez, who has recently been making claims that the U.S. has plans to assassinate him. Do you have any comment on that before we move to John Bolton?
Well, certainly John Bolton's the kind of guy who would love to see Hugo Chavez assassinated. What we have here is a political figure that the Bush family mightn't want to spend a social evening with. That is, he's a very confrontational person, very explosive. He also is a man who is fully prepared to take on multiple enemies at the same time, be it the church, the business groups, the professions, the trade unions. He'll take them on, all of them he'll take on, if he feels that there's a polemical point to make. Now, this confrontational style sometimes masks a personality that is authentically democratic. He is more democratic than most Latin American leaders, since the democracy that he anticipates thinking about is a democracy that's not only a political democracy and based upon a tectonic blah-blah made during political campaigns and so forth, but he's a man who has wrenched himself away from the paramountcy of the Washington Consensus and market reforms, that is the conservative prescription for Latin America. Do away with subsidies. Do away with sort of quotas, social reforms, a mixed economy, state industry. All those forms that Latin America evolved in order to deal with very specific realities out there. The net result has been, starting with in 1990 with the Clinton administration, and certainly following through with the Bush administration, we have had governments that simplistically felt that with the demise of the Soviet Union, the age of ideology was dead, and that trade presumed the entire political social system. The purpose of a nation was trade, or to put it as Calvin Coolidge did in, I think, 1923, he said, the business of America is business. But there's another kind of business, and that is to be sure that you are purveying authentic democracy rather than faux democracy to the citizenry, and that there is an egalitarian structure. There are apertures and landings where people can get into the system. And these are the things that are on Chavez's agenda. And what he has managed to do is he has managed to become kind of a surrogate Castro figure, that the presidents of Brazil and Argentina and Uruguay, who are basically appointing conservative, orthodox, economic visionaries to their Department of Finance and Department of Development. And these people are following, are espousing traditional economic orthodoxy in terms of the modalities that they approach. They have an investment-oriented policy. The purpose is to earn money via the multinationals and international financial institutions and use this revenue to pay for needed social reforms. But the process of getting there is so suspiciously similar to what these populations, and characteristically, at least one-third of the population of every Latin American country lives below the poverty line. These people are used to a lot of talk, and there's no delivery. Now, when Chavez, back in the middle, let's say in 2002, just at the time of the coup, he started the failed coup against Chavez. He started to experiment, but he didn't have any money. It was when the price of oil went up, he was able to generate the revenue, that he was able to win back his constituency, which had fallen to 35% in popularity polls.
He was recently popularly elected, though, by a pretty large majority. We're going to be running out of time pretty soon, and I really want to spend a few minutes talking about John Bolton. You wrote an article about him recently, and I actually managed to find a video and audio clip of some things that he said, which you quote in your article, but I'm going to try and play them now, and hopefully the sound from my small laptop will be picked up enough for people to hear. This is about a minute long, and I want you to, after we hear what John Bolton said, I'd like you to give us a little bit of background on who he is and why it's a bad idea for him to be at the UN.
Okay.
So here's a little sound clip of John Bolton. Well, it would help if I turned the sound up, of course, on my laptop. That would be a good thing. So let me restart that. Just bear with me. All right, here we go.
The point that I want to leave with you in this very brief presentation is where I started. There is no United Nations. There is an international community that occasionally can be led by the only real power left in the world, and that's the United States, when it suits our interests, and when we can get others to go along. Secretariat building in New York has 38 stories. If you lost 10 stories today, it wouldn't make a bit of difference. This kind of mindless creation of the United Nations as something different from what it's in the United States' interest to do isn't going to sell here or anywhere else.
I don't believe for a second.
That was from a meeting in 1994. This is John Bolton's opinion of the UN. You heard him say that the Secretariat building is 38 stories, and if 10 of them disappeared today, it wouldn't make a bit of difference. Who is John Bolton? How did he get where he is, and why is it bad for him to be the U.S. ambassador?
It's a threat to my life, because I used to work in one of those upper stories. And if he's going to eliminate it, I'd like to get a parachute.
So what? I mean, he's making his point pretty forcefully, and in the video clip, which obviously you can't see on radio, he's quite vigorous, and he's pointing his finger and hitting the desk and so on. He's quite animated about all this.
Yes,
what's the story with him?
An animated man. He's kind of like a monkey throwing himself against bars and from one side of the cage to the other. He is one of the most outlandish political players I've ever encountered. Now, mind you, Washington is a place where there are a lot of extremely well-heeled, with Texas money, conservative think tanks. We call them nut tanks. The Heritage Society Foundation is one. That was probably where Bolton was making a speech. The American Enterprise Institute. There are a lot of them. And they're very well-heeled. They have a huge endowment. Now, Bolton comes from one of these think tanks. And you can sense the quality of his thinking by the words, the banalities, the kind of off-the-cuff remarks that he was making in that address. He is a person beyond the realm of acceptable polemics. And Edison and Steele, he's not. He's a crude thinker. He's a sedulous liar. He invents. He depends upon that kind of ultra-right wing infrastructure within the administration that protects him. For example, what happened was a number of months ago, he made the accusation at a speech at the Heritage Foundation that Cuba was exporting bioweaponry to rogue nations abroad, Iraq and Iran and so forth.
We have about 2 minutes left. I just wanted to let you know.
Right. And it turns out that and we asked Rumsfeld, we asked the head of the Southern Command, we asked a whole series of officials, is there any merit to this statement being made that Bolton is making? All of them denied they knew anything about it. Finally, Senator Dodd said, look, we're going to hold Senate hearings. We'd like to have Bolton make his charge. Bolton refused to appear before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. This is an example, and immediately Powell jumped in to protect Bolton. Bolton is a man who needs constant protection because he gets himself into trouble by being himself, which is a kind of an appallingly narrow-minded, bigoted person of no class, no intellectual formation, just a deadly ultra-right-wing nut. And to think that this administration had the temerity of appointing him to occupy the seat once occupied by Adlai Stevenson is really tragic.
Well, on that note, we're going to have to leave it there. You certainly didn't mince your words, and I want to thank you for being with us tonight. Where can people go for your organization's website one more time?
We're at www.coha.org.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Larry Burns. He is the director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. If you tune in tomorrow to KPFT between 8 and 5, you can hear the confirmation hearing of John Bolton. Maybe some of the things that Larry was telling us will appear live on the radio, and you can follow what's going on. Larry Bansky is going to be hosting that. It's 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. tomorrow.
Maybe Bolton will not get confirmation. He'll be appointed to the Supreme Court instead.
But we'll see. We'll see. We'll certainly follow it, and if for some reason the confirmation doesn't go ahead, we'll report on it for you next week. I want to thank Farah Chief for being here, and Pokey Anderson and Byron Jackson. This is Mark Valley saying good night. Thank you for listening. Join us again next week at 6. Coming up now is Pan-African Journal with Akua Holt. This is KPFT Houston. Good night.